This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Scholars have long debated what creates a successful society and what dooms the states that fail. Many have argued that geography is king, so a country sitting atop an arid, desert-like land is sure to be at a disadvantage. Others have argued that the real key is culture. Some cultures are just intrinsically less well-equipped to deal with complex financial markets, or maybe they even place less emphasis on hard work. But my next guests argue that understanding why nations have failed in the past and why they will fail in the future boils down to something completely different, a rationale that may tell us a lot about where America's been and where it is headed. And Darren Acemoglu, professor of economics at MIT, and James Robinson, professor of government at Harvard, join me. They're the authors of Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I want to start with a story that you have in the book, which I think is a very interesting illustration of sort of where these fault lines can occur. And it's the story of a town that's on the U.S.-Mexican border and is essentially the same town in Mexico and the U.S., except the people who live there, they feel very different about it, and their lives are very different. So, Darren Acemoglu, tell us a little bit about this town and why you focus on it in the book.
Well, I mean, the town is Nogales, and it's actually not a unique town. There are many other towns like that around the world and along the U.S.-Mexico border, which are essentially separated by this border. And then the two sides of the border, you see similar people, but with very different living standards, with very different living arrangements. And if you try to sort of explain those differences by geography, you won't find much geographic differences between these two places. You won't find any cultural differences. The same, these borders are pretty porous, so people travel back. It's the same sort of people who have lived there for centuries. But they are, of course, under very different institutions, because in one case, it's the U.S. laws, U.S. customs, U.S. political and economic institutions that are ruling the place. And in the other, it's the Mexican ones. And you see big differences in the way that lives are led, and big differences in the economic outcomes, in prosperity and poverty, living standards, life expectancy. And I think this is sort of a clear and simple illustration of how these institutional differences are at the root of fairly big differences across countries.
Now, James Robinson, somebody might say, well, maybe there is a cultural difference, not necessarily that these people are different religions or celebrate different holidays or even eat different food, but there are people who are part of America, and there's a sort of American work ethic, let's say, versus a Mexican work ethic. Is that a possibility in trying to explain the difference in Nogales?
Well, it's a possibility, but I don't think it's a reality. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't see around the world big differences in people's aspirations or what they want for themselves or their lives. But, and, you know, it's certainly true that some people work harder in the United States. People work longer hours than they do in large parts of Europe, but Western Europe or Northern Europe, for example. But I think that's really a response to the incentives people face, that people have much higher incentives for working hard or innovating or creating, starting a new business in the United States than they do in many other parts of the world. You know, in sub-Saharan Africa, where they may be worried that they'll be predated on, or they can't get secure property rights, or, you know, so I think, to the extent that you see Mexicans or people in the United States working harder, or, you know, or less hard, or working longer, that's really a response to the institutions that structure their incentives.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the difference in the quality of life. I mean, it is very stark. You have an average income in Nogales, Arizona, of $30,000. In Mexico, of $10,000. In that area, although you point out that in other parts of Mexico, it's even lower than that, but partially because of the proximity to the U.S., the people in Nogales, Mexico, are doing a little better.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the relative prosperity of Nogales, you know, Sonora, compared to the rest of Mexico, is exactly driven by investment by U.S. corporations, maquiladora factories, and things like that. So it underestimates the difference, if anything.
So what is the U.S. then doing right? If we were to take either Arizona or anywhere, what are they doing right? What are they giving their citizens that the government of Mexico is not giving their citizens?
Well, I think they're giving them opportunities. You know, I mean, we illustrate this in a simple way. We try to use these stark examples. We illustrate this through the career of Bill Gates and Carlos Slim. You know, so that's sort of iconic, perhaps, of the difference between what the US is giving its citizens as compared to Mexico. You know, how did the two richest men in the world, you know, more or less, Warren Buffett is up there, how did Bill Gates make his money? Well, he innovated. He created software. He's an innovator. Sure, he wanted to be a monopolist. Every businessman wants to be a monopolist, you know, if they can get away with it. How did Carlos Slim make his money? Political connections, insider privatization, completely different, and I think very, very different in a symbolic way.
And Darren Acemoglu from MIT, I think it's really interesting, this Bill Gates example, because you say in the book, individual talent, it does matter. We don't want to discount the fact that Bill Gates worked incredibly hard to get where he is. He's competitive. He's smart, just intrinsically smart. But he didn't necessarily fully make it on his own.
No. I mean, I think he didn't make it on his own because he relied on the education system in the United States. There are probably many, many talented people, some of them perhaps as talented as Bill Gates in sub-Saharan Africa, who don't go to primary school. They start working in the field at the age of 8 or 9. You know, Bill Gates had access to very good high schools, to very good colleges, and then he was able to, you know, he didn't finish Harvard, but he was able to team up with pretty good people. And then from the get-go, he was functioning under the laws, corporate laws, and the corporate relations in the United States that actually enabled somebody very young, just like Google, you know, Google is in the news today, you know, those people were able to sort of do something that's probably unheard of in many parts of the world. You know, 20-year-old nobody is able to start a company. That, again, is possible because of A, the laws and customs in the United States, and B, because people are fairly confident that they, if they are successful, they're going to get the benefits of this. So they actually have the incentives to do so. So as Jim said, you know, two things that are crucial here are opportunities and incentives. United States provides opportunities to people. It doesn't send talented people. It doesn't send people at the age of 10, 12 to the fields or to work as child laborers. It doesn't actually kind of trap them in some totally dysfunctional education system in which all they learn is propaganda, but it also gives them incentives that they actually want to channel their talent, their ambition into doing things that is going to make them successful in the business world.
And you mentioned you have a list of things, some of which we, I think, completely take for granted, but that rich countries have and poor countries often do not. Electricity, good roads, toilets, running water, education, healthcare, law and order, voting. And it results in, as you say, people living longer, people being better educated, people generally making a lot more money. When you hear that list and you think about what it's like in the places that you visited that do not have those things, paint a picture for me of places you've been that don't have them and how that changes somebody's life.
Well, that's I suppose it's difficult for someone to imagine what that's like. Oh, there's plenty of poor people in the United States. You know, being I was just in Nigeria for 2 weeks. 2 weeks actually, it was very interesting because I was there with my 10-year-old son, and he was very struck. Actually, he was very disturbed by the amount of children working. You know, you stop at a traffic light, and suddenly there's all these kids coming to sell you cigarettes or you know whatever it is, or wash your car or something. And he was very disturbed about all these children working. So he kept on saying, Dad, why aren't they in school, these kids? You know, what are they doing? And where are their parents? So I think maybe people adapt to all sorts of things. They adapt to living in a hut with a mud floor with no toilet and no electricity and whatever it is, you know, but you know, they pay a price for that in terms of without books, without access to television or anything like that. They pay a price for that in terms of their health, in terms of, I don't know, you know, but I think those people all have the same aspirations as you and I do. They just don't get the chance to fulfill them.
And why aren't those kids in school? Is it because there aren't schools or they can't afford them?
There are some types of schools. I think, you know, there's no effect work, you know, there's even publicly provided school, but the teacher's probably not there, or there's no books, or, you know, or the parents are very poor. The parents need to send the kids out to earn money in the fields, or, you know, selling stuff on the streets. I was in Kano in the north of Nigeria. So I don't want to say anything about the parents. I think it's just, you know, people in very difficult circumstances, they have to use every option they have. And that's an option in the long run, keeps them poor, but in the short run, gives them something to eat.
Yeah, and it may dictate the way that you use your family or your resources or whatever. Let's switch to a part of the world that has been in the news a lot and that you talk about in the book, the Middle East, North Africa, Central Asia. For example, you talk about Egypt, and I know as you were writing the book, the Arab Spring was going on. And I think, you know, people in the U.S. May look over to the Middle East, to Islamic countries, and think maybe there is a cultural difference because there seems to be a lot of turmoil. There seems to be poverty, and maybe that's what makes Western countries different from these countries. What did you learn, Damon Acemoglu, from the Arab Spring?
I mean, I think, as you said, Islamic countries, especially the Middle East and North Africa, but also, you know, Afghanistan and Pakistan, they're very different from, you know, what you see in Europe or in North America, even Latin America. They are much less democratic. You know, if you leave the oil producers out, they're quite poor. They're, you know, even when they have sort of had movements away from monarchies, those have been very authoritarian, you know, led by a single party or single individual. So the view that many social scientists and certainly journalists and commentators had in the past is, you know, oh, Islam is incompatible with democracy. People just don't want democracy. They want to be led, and they're also perhaps not adapted to Western technology. They're not open to Western technology, and perhaps that's why they're not they're not prospering and they're not becoming democratic. And there are some very reputable, you know, people who've written versions of this. You know, the late political scientist at Harvard, Samuel Huntington, Bernard Lewis, the Princeton historian of the Middle East. But in some sense, the Arab Spring proved two things. First of all, people actually had a very strong desire for democracy. They were willing to risk their lives. And in fact, the way that they achieved it was by using technology. So you don't see any of that closeness to technology in these people who were very skillful in using Facebook and Twitter in order to coordinate how they were going to go around all that repression in order to sort of fill up Tahrir Square and to bring the government down in Egypt, or same thing in Tunisia, same thing in Syria. And that's not to say that there aren't some deep-rooted historical differences, but I think sort of easy generalization based on some markers of any sort of society, you know, be it Islam, be it Protestant ethic, be it sort of national cultures, I think they are at the end too easy, and we sort of need to go beyond them to understand those social dynamics better.
Okay, so the question of why Egypt isn't Norway is not because of an antipathy to technology. But one thing you do, James Robinson, is you go back in the book and look at why is Egypt? Why did they have Hosni Mubarak? I mean, why the deposed leader of Egypt? Why were they in that situation to begin with? And you really have to go back a long ways to figure out why Egypt is in the situation that it is in now.
I think that's right. Countries, institutions, their political and economic organization diverge over very long periods of time, you know, and the roots of the way Egyptian society functions today are in it was part of a colonial empire. We actually make an analogy between Latin America and parts of the Middle East, because the Ottoman Empire, which expanded in the early modern period and incorporated Egypt, you know, was very similar in structure to many other types of empires. It was run from Istanbul, and, you know, Egypt was on the periphery. They were taxing, they were extracting, it was authoritarian. Then it was taken over by the, in the 19th century, Egypt was quite a success, actually. After the Napoleonic Wars, it managed to free itself from the Ottomans. And there was a period of very rapid modernization under Muhammad Ali. But then the British came, they wanted to build the Suez Canal, it became a European colony. And as in many colonies in the rest of in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, after independence of, you know, after independence from Britain, it became, you know, authoritarian, was a military rule. And, you know, so there's many parallels, you know, with other parts of the world, you know, which again makes this Islamic culture or something look much less unique and distinctive about the place.
And you say colonization often brought with it this idea of extraction rather than inclusion. So if America is a country that is generally a country of inclusion, where people get to vote and, you know, people all get to drive on nice roads and that mm-hmm. kind of thing, what is a culture yeah. of extraction, and what does it do to a place like Egypt, say?
Well, I think extraction is probably a very natural human impulse. You know, it's in most parts of the world, you know, you see people who would like to organize a society for their own benefit, to amass wealth and assets and income and power. And, you know, that was the same idea in the United States. The United States is the way it is, not because somebody, you know, designed it like that, but because people fought, you know, to create a very different sort of society. I mean, that's, you know, something we point out at the start of the book as well, that it's about, there was a lot of conflict over institutions, just as there's conflict over institutions in the Middle East today. That was true historically in the founding of the United States during the colonial period. I mean, so I think, you know, extraction, we compare North America to South America, and how the South American, Latin American countries got set up based on the exploitation of indigenous people by a small colonial elite. And that was using forced labor, using tributes, etc. Slavery, you know, slavery, I suppose, might be the sort of canonical example of extraction, of where, you know, some people are just enslaved and have to work for other people. That's an organization of the economy which is disastrous for incentives or technological change or anything else, but of course it's very good for people who are controlling or owning the slaves.
Right, and there's no benefit to those people. It's just labor is taken from them, so it benefits other people, yeah. but not the people who are doing the work.
Yes, and if you look at the U.S. South, for example, you know, the U.S. South was much backward. It was poorer, it was less urbanized, it was technologically less dynamic, it had less infrastructure, less manufacturing, everything compared to the North or the West, and because it was based on this slave model of extraction.
I want to talk a little more about where you see America going, where you see other countries going. You talk a little bit about China, which has been sort of a miraculous place of growth in the last decade or so. I'm speaking with Darren Acemoglu, a professor of economics at MIT, and James Robinson, professor of government at Harvard. Their new book is Why Nations Fail. I'm Kara Miller, and the conversation continues on 89.7. WGBH. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. We're looking at why certain nations thrive while others are doomed to fail. And I'm joined by Darren Acemoglu, a professor of economics at MIT, and James Robinson, professor of government at Harvard. And they're the authors of Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. And Darren Acemoglu, we were talking about this idea of extraction, which people like, for example, Cortez were great at. I mean, they sort of perfected the idea of how do you get to a society and take out the gold or whatever is of worth and keep it for yourself and sort of impoverish the society.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why we start with this colonial example is because I think it's very telling. And, you know, the umbrella term that we use for this sort of institutions are extractive institutions. And, and you know, the colonial empires weren't, you know, people talked about, you know, motivated sometimes the soldiers with, you know, spreading religion, Christianity to the heathens, or the same thing the Ottomans did it with Islam. But really, a lot of the motivation was to actually go and get the gold, get the valuable produce, sugar, spices. And it's, you know, you can see this very well. They introduce forced labor systems, they introduce slavery, all based on coercion. And that sort of really makes clear what this sort of extractive system is. But, come to the present, you know, look at, you know, we were just talking about Hosni Mubarak, for example. Well, actually, you know, the Hosni Mubarak Egypt looks, you know, miles and centuries away from the Aztec Empire and the Spanish Empire in Latin America. But there is a lot of commonality, and that's what the idea of extractive institutions is meant to kind of capture. If you look at the Egyptian economy, it doesn't have slavery, but it's organized in such a way that, you know, there are monopolies created for people aligned with Mubarak and his National Democracy Party. There's a lot of corruption at the top level, including Mubarak himself and his sons. And that all that sort of the logic of that system, both economically and politically, is again for those elites to be able to extract resources. And exactly like in the colonial empire, that's not always inconsistent with economic growth, but ultimately it's going to become a real barrier to economic growth. And as just James mentioned, you know, U.S. South, you know, at the beginning, you know, U.S. South has a lot of valuable commodities. A lot of cotton made the U.S. South rich. At some point, U.S. South wasn't poor at all. But while the North and the West were growing, U.S. South was stagnating. And that's why by the time of the U.S. Civil War and in the 19th century, there was a fairly sizable gap between those two parts.
Yeah, and, you know, you talked about Hosni Mubarak, the former head of Egypt. At the time that he was deposed, it was estimated that he had accumulated $70 billion. Well, this is a country in which the net worth, I think, of individual people is something like 10-12% of people in the U.S. So a very poor country, but boy, he had done really well.
And he's not the only one. You know, so you look at Mobutu, who, you know, ruled the Democratic Republic of Congo, or Zaire, as it was called at the time. Same thing. You know, people are starving and he has several castles, huge Swiss bank accounts, private planes, and all that. And you see that all around the world.
And you can see why it's good for the elites, and they might try to perpetuate it, but you can also see why there might be a revolution at some point. Okay, so let's talk about two countries, look ahead a little bit here, China and America. So let's start with China. China has been, at least over the last decade, and certainly if you talk to people in the financial world, talked about as an economic powerhouse. It's done obviously incredibly well, well over a billion people. This is where growth is coming from. But you question that a little bit in the book, James Robinson.
Yeah.
Where do your doubts about China's potential come from?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously China is very large, and I think that's part of the, you know, what confuses people about how to interpret this experience. You know, yes, China's been growing very rapidly since the late 1970s. And, you know, as we point out, the reason for that rapid growth is they've made this transition towards more inclusive, what we describe as inclusive economic institutions. So they got rid of central planning and socialism and collective agriculture and all of that. And they've seen huge improvements in living standards and productivity. But what we point out is that if you look historically, having that type of economy or movement towards a more inclusive economy is not consistent with having this very extractive political system where political power is narrowly concentrated in the hands of the Communist Party. Indeed, there's many experiences historically which are similar to this. You know, in the 1970s, China was extremely poor, very backward technologically. Any country like that, you know, can get its act together for a short amount of time and grow very rapidly. The Soviet Union did it, as we point out. You know, when I was an undergraduate in England, we were told the Soviet Union was the economic model that everyone should be following. And everyone laughs when you say that now because we've forgotten it. But the Soviet Union did something very similar for 40 years.
You've got a great story, which I did not realize about the Soviet Union, where during the Treaty of Versailles, Woodrow Wilson's in Paris, you know, they're signing the treaty at the end of World War I, and these couple of envoys are sent to the Soviet Union because they're sort of busy with their revolution. They didn't send anybody to the to Paris. And the guy comes back, the envoy to the Soviet Union comes back, and he says, "Wow, this place is amazing. I mean, this could really work, what they're trying to do. This is the future." What happened, Darren Osmond?
He wasn't the only one. I mean, Lincoln Steffens, you know, he was a fairly famous journalist, one of the muckrakers, and sort of an iconic character of the time. But there were many people who were totally taken in. I mean, the CIA was taken in. There were many CIA analysts who, you know, kept warning about how the Soviet Union was going to overtake the United States. And that was, of course, very important for the sort of for the Sputnik generation, where, you know, we started investing so much in space exploration because we wanted to be competitive with Russia. in that thing. And you know, I think the fact that Russia was able to grow like that was even more remarkable, because they did not even take those steps that Jim mentioned towards more inclusive institutions. They did not open up the sort of the agriculture to price incentives with, you know, Deng Xiaoping and the Chinese leadership, especially the local leadership, started doing after 78. They tried to do everything with a command economy. But despite that, there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. You know, when the world technology is ahead, and when you are so inefficiently organized, in the case of Russia, you had a huge agricultural sector that was very inefficient. So what they did is that they sort of borrowed technology, some cases stole technology from the West, and moved people into the heavy industry especially. And that sort of was enough to get growth going for a while. But then when it came to an end, it was a really bad end. Stagnation, total crisis for Russia, because, you know, they weren't able to give any sort of incentive unless you were some very sort of elite scientist working on a very specific project. So they weren't able to generate new technologies. They weren't able to generate new products. And the whole economic sort of edifice started crumbling.
So that brings us back to China. You talk about this one businessman who in the 90s thought, things are going really well in China. Clearly, there's going to be a lot of building. So I have an iron and steel company, and there's going to be tons of need for this. And that company ended up failing. Why, James Robinson? What happened to this company?
Because he started to compete with more politically favored people. He didn't have the right political connections. And so then the politically powerful people put him out of business, got him arrested. And I think that, you know, when ultimately you have a system like that, that fundamentally limits the possibility for sustained economic growth.
So you think that sort of puts up a wall to China somewhere? They're either going to have to push through that wall, or they're going to get stopped by it.
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to say which way that will pan out. You know, it could go in either two directions in some sense. You know, the one direction could be like South Korea. I mean, South Korea in some sense in the 1960s and 1970s, it was very different politically and economically than China. But it was a situation what we call growth under extractive institutions, or extractive growth, in the sense that the political system was a dictatorship. But what happened in Korea was, you know, they made a transition in the 80s, 90s to a more open political system and a much more enduring combination of economic and political institutions. But I would say that's much less likely to happen, though, in China, because the Communist Party is something very different from the military dictatorship in South Korea. And everything I read about the Communist Party suggests that the thing that they really care about is staying in power.
And they, you know, we talked about Hosni Mubarak before, accumulating $70 billion before he was deposed as leader of Egypt. You have people at the top of the Chinese government who similarly have billions of dollars in Swiss bank accounts all around the world, just sort of money set aside. Maybe different family members have it. So, okay. So, Darren Acemoglu, let's talk now about America. And I wonder, mostly in this book, America is really an example of a country that has succeeded because of its institutions and its incentives. And I wonder what you are seeing now, especially in light of growing inequality in America.
Well, I mean, I think America has broadly inclusive institutions. They have, you know, these institutions have provided incentives for people, opportunities for people, but it's important to sort of be realistic about them. You know, those institutions haven't been perfect. They have always been challenged, and they've had many imperfections. You know, United States had, you know, slavery in the South while the North was, you know, industrializing. Then slavery was abolished, but we had the sort of separate but equal, you know, Jim Crow justice, and still very much of a black underclass in the South until the Civil Rights Movement. And that was a struggle too. So you know, U.S. institutions have always had difficulties. But I think we have some sort of unique set of difficulties today because of, you know, in some sense, it's a perfect storm. You know, the thing that makes political institutions really inclusive is that They provide political equality. They don't enable one individual or one specific social group or economic elite to dominate everything, to dominate political power. And U.S. political institutions, despite all of their imperfections, they were able to do that reasonably well. So even when people, with money during the Gilded Age were becoming very powerful, there were movements like the populist movement and the progressive movement. You know, they were able to have their voices heard and finally use some sort of electoral success in order to start changing things. And I think the real danger in the United States, and that's why I call it a perfect storm, is that we have two things going on at the same time. One is that we have a huge increase in inequality. The very top of the income distribution has become much, much richer relative to the rest. You know, the top 1% now commands over 20% of the wealth in income in the United States. That's a huge number, and then together with that, we have money becoming much more important in politics. You know, this is related to perhaps the sort of the modern media being so important for elections. It's important. It's related to lobbying and campaign contributions having become so central. And it's also related to rulings such as Citizens United that have really opened the sluice gates of money pouring into politics. And when you have these two combinations, it really creates a danger that United States is moving towards becoming an oligarchy, a society in which the very top are privileged, they are politically privileged, they are economically privileged in the sense that because they have so much political voice, the politicians are going to shy away from taking policies that are going to be harmful to them. So, you know, today in the United States, we have a lot of political problems, we have a lot of economic problems, we have poverty, we have educational system that's failing, and still, you know, the key thing is whether we should cut taxes further on people who make more than $2 million. So I think that is a little bit indicative that perhaps there isn't a total divorce between economic power and political power.
I'm Kara Miller. We're talking with Darren Acemoglu from MIT and James Robinson from Harvard about why nations fail. And James Robinson, I want to get your take on this. But first, I'm going to play a clip from a conversation I had just last week with a colleague of yours, Michael Sandel from Harvard. And he was talking about this very issue of inequality and sort of this being a country of haves and have-nots. And here he talks about even basic services, in this case, fire departments, starting to break down a little bit. Let's listen.
In growing numbers of communities today, there is greater and greater reliance on private fire companies. And there was an episode a couple of years ago where a house was on fire. It may have been in Tennessee, if I remember correctly. The owner of the house had not subscribed to the private fire department. And so the fire department came, stood by while his house burned, just to make sure it didn't spread to a subscriber's house. So what we're seeing is an individuation of goods, even fire protection, as the market comes increasingly to govern these areas of life, including police and fire protection.
James Robinson, do you see warning signs as Michael Sandel seems to and Darren Acemoglu seems to also?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can always find silly things like that. I grew up in England during the heyday of Mrs. Thatcher when privatize everything, you know, became a dogma. You know, it was a sort of ideology that overrode common sense and even, you know, fundamental principles of economic theory, because of a political agenda. I don't see that sort of thing as, you know, that's... There's always sort of stuff like that going on, but you have to look at the big picture, I would say, I guess. I mean, I don't want to belittle the problem of the person whose house burnt down, but I wouldn't say that really is a sort of leitmotif of the whole situation in the United States. I think my view is very similar. My view is very similar to Darren. I guess my recent experience, though, is that I tend to find myself as being the most optimistic person in the... I'm not an American citizen, actually. I'm British, but I see that, you know, we study parts of the world which are very dysfunctional compared to the United States. And I think that, you know, we point out in the book that historically, the U.S. institutions have faced lots of challenges, but they've been up to those challenges. You know, not just the example that Darren gave of the Gilded Age, but you think about the 1930s, and you know there was this whole we talk about in the book about how Franklin Roosevelt, tried to pack the Supreme Court and kind of dismantle checks and balances in the political system, and again, there was a backlash in society that the democratic system worked to stabilize that. So I suppose I still see, you know, yes, there are these dynamics that Daron was talking about, but I don't see this increase in inequality as yet having, you know, oligarchized the industrial sector, you know, or sapping the energy of innovative or private sector entrepreneurs, you know, in the way that I study Colombia, for example. I was just on sabbatical in Colombia for a year. You know, if you look at the economy in Colombia, it's all divided up, you know, monopolies, cartels, you know, there's no innovation. It's all about, you know, making connections with the politicians and getting favors and contracting. And, you know, and of course you can find examples like that in the United States too, you know, in Chicago or whatever, or corrupt, you know, but the system still works. You know, the example we gave in the book, Bill Gates, for all his power and enormous wealth, couldn't stop himself being dragged in front of the antitrust bodies and being penalized. You know, you couldn't imagine in a million years anyone like that in Colombia or Mexico being dragged in front of antitrust.
And in our last minute here, give us some of the countries, just a short list of countries that you think may be poised to break through and go from maybe not so much prosperity to really doing well in the next 10, 20 years.
One of the examples we use in the book, we talk about in the book, is Brazil, actually. I think one of the countries which seems to have experienced a kind of very fundamental change in the way its political system works, with consequences for the economy, education, innovation, is Brazil. You know, we emphasize, I suppose, a lot in the book, this, you know, how persistent different institutions in society are. But we do also try to emphasize, you know, under what circumstances can you get these transitions? For example, you know, what sort of transition is happening in Egypt now? And I, you know, Brazil is the example we use at the end.
And Darren Osmoglu, you want to add a country? Or?
Well, I mean, I think a country that's interesting is the one that I come from, Turkey, which has a lot of institutional problems. And if you look at it, you know, you'll see economic failure, political failure. There is a real danger of, the same sort of political wranglings that have harmed Turkish economy and Turkish society over the last several decades coming back. But on the other hand, you also see that there is much greater popular participation both in politics and in the economy. You have the military now totally cast aside, and as a result, there is a new dynamism in the society, and you see that in much more robust growth rates in Turkey.
Interesting. We will be watching. I've been speaking with Darren Osmoglu, Killian Professor of Economics at MIT, and James Robinson, David Florence Professor of Government at Harvard. They are the authors of Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Cara. It was great to be here.
Thank you.
And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3. Hey, Callie.
Kara, as you know, same-sex marriage has been a hot topic in this election season. We're going to talk to someone who's doing what he can to make people more sympathetic to this issue. And that's Gene Robinson, the Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire. I'm Callie Crossley.
I'm Kara Miller. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.